Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. The Islamic militant group Hamas says that the ruling of Gaza, in a statement, that it will dissolve its administrative body and hold general elections. That decision is seen as a way to end a political and territorial rift between Hamas and President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement. The move opens an avenue to form a reconciliation government. The rival Palestinian governments have been at loggerheads since a civil war in 2007, when Hamas expelled the Palestinian Authority from Gaza. British police now say that they have arrested a second suspect in connection with the bombing of a subway train in London. Police said in a statement that they arrested a 21-year-old man in the West London suburb of Hounslow, which is home to London's Heathrow Airport, just before midnight Saturday. He was arrested under Britain's Terrorism Act. Earlier Saturday, another suspect, an 18-year-old man, was arrested in the port area of Dover, a major ferry terminal for travel between Britain and France. The United States has signaled to the European Union's top energy official that it will and may be willing to re-engage in the Paris Climate Pact, despite President Donald Trump's announcement in June that the U.S. would withdraw in order to renegotiate the deal. The European Commissioner for Climate Action and Energy said Saturday that the shift came during a meeting in Montreal of more than 30 ministers led by Canada, China, and the European Union. The Montreal meeting took place in preparation for the annual United Nations General Assembly, the main events of which began on Tuesday. However, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders tweeted a different message shortly after the statement was released. She said the position on the Paris Agreement has not changed. This is VOA News. Violent protests in the U.S. city of St. Louis, Missouri continue. Demonstrators are upset with the acquittal of a white police officer charged with murder and the death of an African-American man. A small band of protesters began breaking windows and throwing objects at police, who say nearly two dozen people have been arrested and nine police officers injured in skirmishes with the protesters. Racial tension in the area is not new, however. One of the suburbs of St. Louis is Ferguson, Missouri. That's where 2 weeks of protests began in August of 2014 with the shooting death of an 18-year-old African-American man by a white police officer. The Bangladesh government plans to construct a large camp to house some of the 400,000 Rohingya Muslims who have poured in from neighboring Myanmar over the past 3 weeks. Refugee International Chief Eric Paul Schwartz visited a camp for Rohingyas today.
I believe that in situations like this, the sternest and strongest measures must be taken. Our values demand it and our interests demand it. There ought to be multilateral sanctions against the Burmese military. There ought to be an arms embargo. There ought to be a referral of the situation in Burma to the International Criminal Court. The United States should reimpose the sanctions that have been lifted over the past several years.
UN agencies are concerned the continued violence in Myanmar may eventually force up to 1 million Rohingya and to Bangladesh, a poor country that is already overpopulated. A roadside bomb in northwestern Pakistan Sunday killed a senior government official and at least four of his security guards. The deadly blast took place in a volatile, federally administered tribal district on the Afghan border. Officials said the administrator of the Mamund sub-district was being driven to a border village to attend a traditional assembly of tribal leaders when his vehicle struck an improvised explosive device. A spokesman for the anti-state Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for planting the roadside bomb in a statement sent to media. They asserted that the blast killed seven people. The outlawed extremist group and its breakaway factions plot attacks in the border region and elsewhere in Pakistan. A French journalist held for 51 days on terror charges in Turkey has returned to Paris. The freelance journalist, Loup Bureau, was met by his parents Sunday at an airport, according to the campaign group Reporters Without Borders. Bureau said in his release it came as a bit of a surprise, as he saw no signs of pointing to his release Friday, a day after the French foreign minister met with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The purpose of this last visit to Nigeria was to actually see all of the young girls who were held in captivity by Boko Haram for 3 years.
A U.S. Congresswoman, Frederica Wilson, visits Chibok girls in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
We are Namibia Wildlife Resort. We are a company created by an act of parliament. And our mandate is actually to run all the accommodation facilities in the national parks.
The Namibian government launches a drive to showcase the country's tourism potential.
The coming back of Angelo Taban will not be the solution to our problem, and the president knows it very well.
And the South Sudanese president, Salva Kiir, fires at the governor of Wau State. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The U.S. Congress Foreign Affairs Committee conducted a hearing into the future of democracy and governance in Liberia Wednesday, this recalling the West African country's emergence from the ruthless civil war orchestrated by jailed former President Charles Taylor. Ed Royce, chairman of the committee, commended Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf for leading efforts in preserving peace, rebuilding infrastructure and economy despite enormous challenges. Dr. Alan White, who played a key role in gathering evidence against Charles Taylor, was at the hearing. In part two of this interview, I asked him about the possibility of retributive justice in Liberia after the October elections.
Will the U.S. support the full implementation of the TRC recommendations? Because Liberians, I understand, were in full support of its implementation. For some reason, it's been delayed.
From my discussions with people on the Hill yesterday and previously, they are adamant about ensuring that at least the next administration implement the TRC. But clearly, the next president of Liberia will be taken to task to make sure that there is accountability and there is retributive justice. And I'm convinced that the U.S. government, and particularly the U.S. Congress, would support it because I've talked to members yesterday and they said they fully supported it and were anxiously awaiting to work on legislation to do what they could to assist implementing such a tribunal.
Looking at the upcoming elections, will the congressional folks perhaps choose some observers to monitor the elections?
Yes, again, that was made abundantly clear yesterday, both by State Department and USAID, that they have employed through NGOs as well as State Department efforts to ensure that these elections are monitored very closely. And in addition to that, all of the election observing organizations who were present, from what they said, all of the major election observation organizations will be there monitoring this. And I can tell you Congress is very, very keenly aware and will be watching this election very, very closely.
Let's look at the upcoming election. Are there any issues that you are concerned about?
Well, it's clear if the reports are factual that we're getting, and of course I have numerous contacts in country and certainly over here in the U.S. as well as around the world that very much want to see this. There is a choice, and if they want retributive justice, then the Liberians will have a voice at the election. On October 10th, they'll have an option of who they want and which candidate will speak for retributive justice for all the people. And whoever that is will not only be held accountable by the Liberian people, certainly the international community, as well as the U.S. government and the U.S. Congress, will keenly be watching this very closely to make sure that this is done. Because now the next phase is to make sure that Liberia heals. And just like in Sierra Leone, the only way that the country could move on and reconcile was to have people held accountable. Once they were held accountable, especially the senior people that have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity, certainly involved in killings, sexual assaults. And quite frankly, that still continues today. We met some other people from Liberia that were actually over here at a USAID conference that had indicated that sexual gender violence is still happening in the country. So there has to be this next phase, has to be healing, restorative justice, and that will be through retributive justice.
Before we leave, what was the overarching message of the congressional hearing yesterday?
Really three things. The rule of law has to be implemented with free and fair elections, and that the U.S. government would be watching that very, very closely. Secondly, they wanted to make sure that those people that had committed the atrocities were held accountable. And thirdly, to deal with the corruption in the country, because the corruption is rampant, and they want to make sure that that's addressed. So those are the big areas. And, of course, one of the other issues that came up that is very, very important is health care and dealing with the Ebola crisis and those types of things. So really there were four, but they want to make sure that the community has access to some health care, because there were reports yesterday where people had been denied health care in Liberia and that they weren't ready for the Ebola crisis and, quite frankly, just in general, community health care. So these are some major issues. But the U.S., at least yesterday, it was my impression, understanding, they will be following these issues very, very closely.
Thank you very much, Dr. White.
Thank you.
Dr. Alan White played a key role in gathering evidence against former Liberian President Charles Taylor. He spoke with me from here in the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. The 106 Chibok girls released by Boko Haram are set to begin their educational career at American University Yola after an elaborate farewell by the Nigerian government. Speaking at the center of dinner, Minister for Women Affairs and Social Development Hajia Jumai Al-Hassan expressed satisfaction with the result of the girls' medical and psychological evaluation following months of rehabilitation. U.S. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, who advocates for the Chibok girls, spoke with VOA Hausa Service reporter Grace Al-Heri Abdu about her recent interactions with the girls.
Well, the purpose of this last visit to Nigeria was to actually see all of the young girls who were held in captivity by Boko Haram for 3 years. It's a miracle, and I wanted to be a part of the miracle and witness the miracle. Since they were released, the last set of them were released, the 82 were released, I have been trying my best to get to Nigeria, and finally I was able to go.
So you were able to, I believe, not only see the girls, but talk with them. What did they tell you? What was their experience, and how do they feel now?
Well, what they did mostly was entertain us. They played the drums. They sang. We danced with them. We didn't try to delve into their private experiences, because we had gotten written testimony from the government about some of their experiences. So rather than try to re-traumatize them by asking them personal questions, we sang with them, and I made a speech, and I told them how every Wednesday Congress wears red, and we take a picture, and I told them that I pray for them every day, even before I pray for myself, and how much we love them, and how we will continue to pray for those who are still in captivity.
We understand that none of the girls came back pregnant. Is that true?
There were four who had babies already delivered. It is my understanding from the first group that was released, I think it was 21 of them, they talked about some of the girls who died in childbirth, but only four were released who actually brought children out with them in the negotiations.
We understand that the girls have limited access to their parents and other family members. How do they feel about that?
I think that was before we got there. When we got there, that part had passed. and they have access to them. In fact, they were in the process of releasing them to their parents. But they wanted to, from what the people, the government said and what the women said who run the facility, was, can you imagine being held captive with terrorists, men who frighten you every single day for 3 years? When you are released, you are not normal. Your psychic is not too good. So they had to debrief them and help them. And I think what they were trying to do, because these girls had been together so long, to separate them would have traumatized them, in my estimation. I think the decision they made to keep them together was the best thing they could have done.
Yeah, because some people were even criticizing the fact that having been in the forest with their abductors for that long, what they needed was their family members, and people were thinking that keeping them in a facility is like imprisoning them again.
I don't necessarily agree with that. We don't know the conditions of those parents, to tell you the truth, because they were the victims of Boko Haram also. So their village was destroyed. You know, that whole Borno State area was destroyed. So where were these parents going to take these children? You had to make sure that this was the appropriate place to release them to. So the parents have been to the facility to see the children. It's not that they haven't seen them. That's not true.
Frederica Wilson is a U.S. congresswoman. She spoke with Grace Al-Hairy Abdu from VOA's House of Service in Washington. The Namibian government has launched a drive to boost the country's tourism potential and raise funds to improve the living conditions of citizens. This came after Parliament established the Namibian Wildlife Resort with a mandate to administer all accommodation facilities in the country's national parks. Officials say the Namibian Wildlife Resort Company plans to raise about $223 million next year. To learn more, I read Zelna Hengari, Managing Director for the Namibian Wildlife Resort, while she was in New York for meetings.
We are Namibia Wildlife Resorts. We are a company created by an act of parliament, and our mandate is actually to run all the accommodation facilities in the national parks. Tourism in Namibia is growing and growing very, very fast. In fact, maybe the fastest growing industry so far.
What does Namibia have to offer to both people on the continent, Namibians themselves, and people outside the continent?
For the longest time, because of the historical linkages to South Africa, a lot of people did not know Namibia. The government of the Republic of Namibia has mandated the Namibia Tourism Board and Namibia Wildlife Resort to make sure that we market the country. Namibia is a part of the largest transfrontier conservation area in the Northeast. That is consisting of five countries. That is Angola, Namibia, Zambia, Botswana, and Zimbabwe. Namibia has two UNESCO-proclaimed heritage sites. That is the Petrified Forest and Namib Sand Sea. We have the largest canyon in Africa, second to the United States, Grand Canyon.
Some people are saying people usually do not like coming to Africa because of the political situation, instability, and all that. How attractive is the political environment, stability-wise, that you think could encourage people, not only people in the Western countries, but other Africans, because Africans rarely visit each other's countries?
Yes, sir. Namibia is a democratic country. We are a very safe, politically, country. In the past 27 years since independence, we had three elected presidents. We have peace. From the tourism side, we have taken a decision to make sure that we attract not only the international travelers, but to actually reach out to our African sisters and brothers. By this, we are also a strategic partner with our national carrier, Air Namibia. And from March 2018, Air Namibia will start to fly again back to Ghana, Accra, and also Lagos, Nigeria. That is now reaching out to our brothers and sisters in Africa. In Southern Africa, we are actually also one of the carriers. Namibia does travel regionally in a few countries like Zimbabwe, Botswana, South Africa, and Angola. So we are reaching out to our, from the NWR side, we are also having a card called the NAMLASIA card, where we are giving all our SADC residents 25% discount if they on accommodation if they come and stay at our facilities.
How much money is your government aiming to raise with this drive?
It is different for Namibia. I can just give you a bit of statistics here. In 2 years ago, we recorded arrival rate of 1.4 to 1.5 arrivals, tourists coming to Namibia. That is now all throughout Africa and other continents. Then when the monetary wise, it was 3 billion Namibian dollar recorded. So what we are aiming for now, 2018, is actually to increase the arrival of the tourists to 1.6. Mind you, as much as we are a big country, Namibia, the population is only 2.2 to 2.3. So you don't want to oversupply. It's a small boutique destination. You want to keep it for conservation purposes as boutique as possible. So which means that in 2018, if we reach this goal of 1.6, then we are expecting to get in the US dollar 23 million. Money of tourism is not actually very easy to squander, but nothing is impossible in this world. It's very, very difficult to squander money. It goes directly to where it's supposed to go and it's properly recorded.
Zelna Hengari is the managing director for the Namibian Wildlife Resorts. She spoke with me from New York. The United Nations reports world hunger is rising because conflict and problems related to climate change are multiplying. The report finds about 815 million people globally did not have enough to eat in 2016, 38 million more than the previous year. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The statistics in this report are particularly grim. They show that global hunger is on the rise again after more than a decade of steady decline. The report, a joint product by five leading UN agencies, warns that malnutrition is threatening the health of and compromising the future of millions of people worldwide. The report says 155 million children under age five suffer from stunting of their bodies and often their brains, thereby dimming prospects for the rest of their lives. It notes 52 million, or 8% of the world's children, suffer from wasting or low weight for their height. Executive Director of the UN Children's Fund, Anthony Lake, says the lives and futures of countless children are blighted because of food insecurity, and those trapped by conflict are most at risk.
Millions of children across northeast Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan, Yemen, and elsewhere, innocent victims of a deadly combination of protracted, irresponsible conflicts, of drought, poverty, and climate change. If unreached, a generation of children, more likely someday as adults, to replicate the hatred and conflicts of today.
The report also explores the problems of anemia among women and growing obesity among adults and children as well. This study does not present a favorable outlook for the UN's Sustainable Development Goal of ending hunger and all forms of malnutrition by 2030. Authors of the report say governments must set goals and invest in measures to bring down malnutrition and to promote healthy eating for healthy living. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has fired the governor of Wild State. The move was announced on state television in a presidential decree. No explanation was given.
Residents of Wau State have expressed mixed reaction to the appointment of the new state governor, Angelo Taban Biagio. Some say they do not want Taban leading the state again, accusing him of killing many people and destroying the social fabric of communities. Other residents welcomed the Taban appointment, saying he could address insecurity in the state. For VOA, Michael Atit has more from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
Wau resident James Mahmoud could not hide his disappointment about the news of Taban's appointment as the governor of Wau State. Speaking in Arabic, Mahmoud claims Taban is linked to a number of deaths in his state and believes violence will only escalate under his governorship.
The coming back of Angelo Taban will not be the solution to our problem, and the president knows it very well. In fact, it will make things worse because he has blood on his hands, and he is not shy to admit it.
Wau resident Oliver Pasquale says the new governor should listen to the people and change his brutal tactics in order to win the confidence of the citizens of Wau State.
He has to work very hard and have to change the policy, actually. This is what, for me, I look, because otherwise, because if you have to learn from the past, the mistakes, this is what a human being always do. If you have a problem, then you need to reconcile with your brother, you need to change your policy, and you need to work hand by hand with people.
Governor Taban was a minister of local government and law enforcement in the former Western Barragazal state. Assunta Vonjo is a mother of four. Speaking in Arabic, Vonjo says Taban's insulted women in Wau, who will only forgive him if he makes a public apology to women.
We wish that we never had to see him again, but it seems the president appointed him so that he can fix his own mess, which he created before. He needs to understand that. And if he can fix his mess, then we will welcome him as our governor. Otherwise, things will just get worse.
James Aganj, the Secretary General for Youth Union in Wau. Aganj welcomes the appointment of Governor Taban, saying he expects the new governor to work with youth to address security challenges in Wau State.
Now the security of Wau State is at least coming to the situation which is normal. We expect Angelo Taban to come and do more report on security, say that our people who are suffering in POC protection side and those who are dispersed in forest should be able to come back and coexist in peace.
David Santino Zinvel also welcomes Taban's appointment. Speaking in Arabic, Santino says he is confident that Taban is the right person for the job.
We expect the coming back of Angelo Taban to Wau will restore security in Wau State because we are going through difficult times. We want stability in Wau for the economy and the political and security situation. And let Angelo Taban try to build better relationships this time around.
Taban replaced Andrea Mayara Cho, who was appointed 1 year ago and fired last night. President Kiir also fired the head of military intelligence, General Marial Nur Jok, last night and appointed him as an ambassador at South Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. President Kiir did not name a replacement for General Nur. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The United Nations General Assembly is meeting in New York, and VOA Africa is providing extensive coverage. We'll hear from world leaders about today's pressing issues. News of the latest developments, along with analysis. VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa. The 72nd United Nations General Assembly opens with a theme focusing on people, striving for peace and a decent life for all on a sustainable planet. Host Shaka Sali and his guest will discuss the UNGA's theme and its importance for the people of Africa. On the next, Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Cape Verde are the biggest overall movers in the latest FIFA World Rankings as they climb a total of 47 places. The Blue Sharks' two victories over South Africa in 2018 World Cup qualifying has seen them move from the 114th place to 67th globally and 13th in Africa. Despite falling 5 places overall, Egypt are still the highest-ranked nation on the continent. The Pharaohs are just 1 place ahead of North African rivals, Tunisia. Tunisia replaced DR Congo as the second-ranked side in Africa after the Carthage Eagles beat the Leopards and drew with them in 2018 qualifying. DR Congo fall 14 places globally, down to 4th on the continent, behind 3rd-placed Senegal. Germany has returned to the number one side in the world, ahead of Brazil for top spot. Still in football, holders TP Mazembe of DR Congo won the first leg of their Confederation Cup quarterfinals against Al Hilal Obeid 2-1 in Sudan on Saturday. Ben Malango struck twice for the defending champions to give them the advantage heading into their home leg next weekend. In other quarterfinal first leg matches, Karim Banarif hit a 19th-minute penalty to give Morocco's FUS Rabat a slender 1-0 win in their home leg against Tunisia's CX Sfaxien. Algerian side Mouladia Alga also won their home leg 1-0 on Saturday against another Tunisian side, Club Africain. On Friday, South Africa's SuperSport United were held to a goalless draw at home by Zambia's Zesco United. In the African Champions League, Feravgiori de Beira of Mozambique scored an 89th-minute equalizer to draw 1-1 at home to USM Alger in the first leg of their African Champions League quarterfinal. Beira are the first side from Mozambique to progress from the group stages of Africa's Premier Club competition. USM will host the return match in Algiers on Saturday, September 23rd. In the other match on Saturday, record 8-time Africa champions Al Ahly of Egypt conceded 2 away goals against Tunisia's Esperance in a 2-2 draw in Alexandria. The quarter-final lineup is dominated by North African teams, with 6 of the 8 clubs from the region. On Sunday, the holders Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa host Morocco's Wydad Casablanca. Libya's Al Ahly Tripoli take on Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia in the other first leg fixture on Sunday. And in athletics, Asef Mengisu Negeo came back to the marathon that launched him onto the international stage in 2016 and destroyed the quality field to successfully defend his title at the Cape Town Marathon on Sunday. Second was countryman Katema Negese, with Duncan Maiyo of Kenya taking third. The women's race saw Bethlehem Mogaz win in 2 hours, 30 minutes and 22 seconds, Johannes coming through 6 seconds adrift, and Agnes Kiprop coming in third. The race boasted a mass field of just under 8,000 entrants, cementing its position among the continent's most popular road running events. Meanwhile, Viola Jepchumba returned to winning ways at the Czech Half Marathon, while Beselias Kipiego retained his title on Saturday. Both athletes broke the course records, with Jepchumba chopping 71 seconds off the women's mark and Kipiego shaving 1 second off the standard he set last year. Jepchumba's finishing time of 1 hour, 6 minutes and 6 seconds was a Bahrainian record and a huge improvement on the previous course record set in 2015 by former world record holder Perez Jepchichir. 38-year-old Nancy Kiprop came in second, just 1 second ahead of last year's runner-up Luce Cheruiyot. and Barcelas Kipyego making his third successive appearance at this event, one in 59.14, exactly 1 second quicker than his winning time from last year. The 24-year-old Kenyan beat Josephat Tanu, competing in just the third half marathon of his career, who took more than a minute off his personal best to take second place at 59.22. Tanzania's Ismail Juma, meanwhile, was rewarded with the Tanzanian record of 59.30 in third place. Finally in boxing, Gennady Golovkin's world middleweight title fight with Saul Canelo Alvarez ended in a controversial draw on Saturday. Kazakh Golovkin, who is 35, retains his WBA, WBC and IBF titles and remains unbeaten in 38 fights. Alvarez, his Mexican opponent, who is 27, now has a record of 49 wins with 34 knockouts, 2 draws and 1 defeat from 52 fights. Saturday's draw gives Alvarez a contractual right to a rematch, most likely in May 2018. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Some of them never know me. Some of them don't know me. Some of them keep for me. Every time the people don't sing, some of them wanna whine for me. Some of them boogie down for me. We love the way the ladies are whining for me. Everybody now, like a hey. Everybody, hey. I like the way you do it, hey. Huh. My DJ said, all my ladies are whining on me. Like a CJ said, hey. All my boom boom, yeah, you there. All the ladies are on a day. Move your body to the beat, yeah. Love me, love me. Need me, need me. All my ladies, everybody, they want me. The sexy body girls, they need me. She said, love me, she love me. She want me, yeah, she want me.
Sexy girl, yeah, bring it on. Star boy, you know we shut it off.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Wamam's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The General Assembly opened its 72nd annual session last week when the president of the assembly was sworn in. The General Assembly will then hold its annual general debate this week, beginning on Tuesday. The United Nations is expecting over 100 heads of state and government to attend, and among them, a large number of African heads of state and government. In the annual debate, heads of state and government will articulate their concerns and views on a wide range of political, economic, social, and humanitarian problems over the last year. But before the General Assembly opened its 72nd session, it also decided last week to end its 71st session. And in that meeting, the General Assembly adopted 6 draft resolutions, and among them was a very significant draft resolution which has been on the agenda of the General Assembly for decades. It was entitled The United Nations in Global Economic Governance. It was adopted by 86 votes, 2 votes against the United States and Israel, and 42 abstentions, mostly members of the European Union and allied Western powers. The argument was that they needed more time for negotiations to get a consensus. Now, even though the Assembly adopted that resolution, it will have no impact in the work of the organization, for the reasons which were outlined by the United States representative to explain his country's votes. The General Assembly can only make recommendations to member states and does not have the same power and legal impact as inscribed in Article 25 of the Charter, where member states are obligated to carry it out. But it was a very important resolution, even though it has failed over the decades, because it represents the marginal role ascribed in the UN Charter to the General Assembly on economic global management. But during the time of the intense Cold War, when the General Assembly, by some fluke, was given more authority, was magnified, developing countries tried their best to change what was in the Charter. And the leader in this group was an eminent Argentinian economist, Dr. Raul Prebisch, a man who is seen in Latin America as their own Mayor Keynes, Keynes being the famous British economist who actually formulated the current global structure of economic governance. And what they did was to try to form organizations such as UNCTAD, Trade and Development, and UNIDO to deal with industrial influence. Because at that time, the United States and its Western allies were not willing to exchange technological development to member states outside of their own alliance system. And that was what UNIDO was supposed to do. But despite this formulation of these two organizations, they were actually marginalized throughout the period. And finally, the United States was able to win out when WTO was established as an independent organization for trade. And this is what was being attempted in the resolution this week, to bring in the United Nations into global management. But this is not going to happen because the structure of global governance, economic, was placed in the hands of the Bretton Woods institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. And the main difference between those institutions and the UN is that in the IMF and the World Bank, you have what is called weighted voting, not one man or one state, one vote, as in the General Assembly. And that's why the Western powers are not willing to give any power to the General Assembly for economic management. Now, the same thing applies to the political side, where the preponderant power and influence is in the hands of the five permanent members. And these five permanent members are now in the main seats in the Security Council. So, to put it bluntly, the world structure for global political and economic governance remained unchanged since 1945. And that is why it is very unlikely that the Security Council will be reformed or that you'll find any meaningful change in the Bretton Woods institutions, World Bank and IMF. China and others have tried to go to alternative routes. For example, the formation of the BRICS organization and China's decision to form a development bank. But this is not going to work because many African states are not members of BRICS, only South Africa. Only now an attempt is being made to bring in Nigeria. And the dependence syndrome, which is so prevalent in Africa, and the dependence on the IMF and World Bank will make it unlikely that we are going to see any major change in global economic and political changes. Thank you very much.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Aidan Utku, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a waterside stone is not afraid of rain. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Cameroon health officials are using new and upgraded tools to detect disease outbreaks at the earliest possible moment in order to respond effectively in a sophisticated exercise designed to test Cameroon's public health emergency management preparedness. The exercise began September 7th and ended September 15th. All of the tools and mechanisms that Cameroon, with U.S. assistance, has developed the last 2 years, such as improved laboratories, real-time surveillance, point of entry, medical countermeasures, risk communications, a new cadre of disease detectives, and an emergency operations center, were tested in responding to a simulated cholera outbreak originating in a small parish near Douala. Representatives from Cameroon's Ministry of Health, regional health centers, and laboratories, along with experts from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, as well as other partners, participated. This 11-day exercise allows participants and monitors to assess health officials' proficiency in tasks ranging from the collection of samples and the use of rapid diagnostic tests to the activization of Cameroon's Public Health Emergency Operations Center in Yaoundé, a new facility currently under construction. Senior public health officials' decision-making processes were also observed. This exercise, rooted in Cameroon's participation in the Global Health Security Agenda, or GHSA, is an important milestone that will test, document, and verify Cameroon's progress in meeting GHSA's important goals. GHSA was globally launched in February 2014 to improve the capabilities and reliabilities of nations worldwide to close gaps that allow disease outbreaks to emerge and spread. Cameroon was one of the earliest and most active members, which today counts more than 60 nations. Through GHSA, CDC Cameroon will receive more than $11 million during the next 3 years, in addition to the current ongoing investments of over $15 million through various activities from the U.S. Defense Threat Reduction Agency, U.S. Agency for International Development, and CDC. Cameroon joined the United States and 28 other nations as founding members of GHSA, a broad initiative to make the world safer and more secure from global health threats posed by infectious diseases. The United States is proud to work with Cameroon and other nations to help protect those most vulnerable to deadly disease.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.